There it goes.
All
first
right.
Time.
Good job. Welcome. I open the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency on September 17th, 2014. This is an informational meeting, and so we have invited testimony only. And I want to start off by thanking former Chair Holvey for helping bring me up to speed on many of these issues and for the fabulous job that you have been doing. And also want to thank our committee administrator, Jan Nordlund, who has just been phenomenal in the last few months. And I want to turn it over to Jan because we have several new protocols that I think you'll want to share.
You've probably heard this already, committee members, but we have a new recording system. The benefit is that you get recorded, archived audio and video now. But you, there's a little delay when you're about to start a meeting. You don't see the flashing blue light anymore. So we like you to wait until the light is solid and on. The other issue bring for you is a background brief. This one is a brand new one. It's on consumer protection. It's on the UTPA. Committee Services prepares about 90 background briefs, and every 2 years we update them, add new ones. And we just want to remind you that they are available on the website, so you can scroll through and see all 90 of them. Let us know if you have any questions about them. If there's any topics that you feel are missing, we would like to know about that, and we can add to it. And the other is a reminder that Monday is the deadline to request bills for pre-session filing. So Monday, 5 o'clock.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Well, we'll start with our agenda. We are actually going to take the first one and put it last because of scheduling needs by people on other panels. So we're going to start with Representative David Gomberg and Representative Kim Thatcher and Summer Warner on the Task Force on Procuring through Small and Local Businesses. Follow up to House Bill 2667, passed in 2013. Want to say anything else about it?
No, I know some of the members heard this very good presentation. It was in Business and Labor, but since it's a topic that has a lot of application, it fit in well with government efficiency, so they're asked to present it here.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Kenny Geyer, former Chair Holvey, Vice Chairs, and representatives.
Margaret.
And my apologies to those of you that did hear this report previously. This is a report from the Interim Task Force on Procuring through Small and Local Business. We did prepare a 43-page report following weeks of testimony and discussions, and I'm just going to take a few minutes to read through that entire 43-page document for you very slowly and then take questions.
Good.
Or I can give you the executive summary. Well, let me say, first of all, for the record, State Representative David Gomberg from House District 10 with me today, Representative Thatcher, who is a very important part of our task force, and Ms. Summer Warner, who was staffing us and did most of the work in preparing the document that's available for you on OLIS. The Task Force on Procuring through Small and Local Business was created by House Bill 2667 in 2013 with the directive of studying public contract awards to minority-owned, women-owned, and emerging small businesses in the state of Oregon. More specifically, we were asked to examine the extent to which state agencies award public contracts to targeted firms, to evaluate the extent to which large procurements could be feasibly broken down into smaller procurements, to recommend incentives that can help to induce agencies to award public contracts, and finally to report that study to the legislature, which I'm doing today. The task force held 7 weekly hearings and heard presentations from state and local government, from nonprofit assistance programs, from targeted firms, and all of them brought us pertinent information on state contracting. Now, the theme emerged consistently that for a variety of reasons, many eligible firms chose not to certify with the state. They did so because of perceived difficulty of the application process and because of no assurance that certification would actually lead to contracts. Firms are simply choosing not to certify, and the state is missing the opportunity to partner with these businesses. Additionally, we found that a number of eligible firms were not certified, but could have been certified, and they still receive state contracts. And because the state relies on the certification process to validate and track procurement, we're unable to track those contracts, and therefore we're understating the state's progress in accomplishing our goals. So we found many reasons why eligible firms chose not to certify and even to do business with the state. The first thing they said to us that the application process is very long and very difficult. And we don't want to bother with it. They also said that the application process requires a lot of very detailed personal information, and in some cases, we just don't want to tell the state that much about who we are and what we're doing. They said that there was no assurance of benefit, that maybe if we certify, we still won't get contracts, or we don't have to certify and we can still get those contracts. Some companies noted the time lag in getting paid. That is a very small company that you just don't have the flexibility to wait several months to get reimbursed when you submit an invoice to the state. And some of them talked to us about limited access to capital. That basically, they couldn't get enough money to build a business to the point where they could manage the kind of contracts that are available. Overall, it appears that the number of firms that are certified and the number of dollars going to those firms is declining. The interesting exception is the African American community, where the number of contracts and the number of dollars is increasing. And we saw through that community that we have a positive example of how progress can be made. We also learned that construction firms are being sufficiently supported, although there's, of course, always room for improvement, but that non-construction firms dealing in goods and services need more attention. Currently, there's no formal way to involve, include, and to reach out to non-construction firms. And finally, we noted that it appears the state is awarding contracts to a narrow number of certified firms. That is to say that fewer firms are getting a lot of contracts. But the goal should be to reach out to more companies, to diversify the number of companies qualifying for state contracts, and to broaden the number of companies qualifying in this program. So again, what we learned going in is that fewer firms are getting fewer dollars, and that and the number of firms that are seeking certification is declining. As many as 25% of the companies that begin the certification process don't complete it. So we developed a number of recommendations on how to address those problems that we identified. The task force goal was to develop strategies on how to increase the number of certified firms. And while there are many state and community programs that support those targeted groups and help to help them start and grow their business, it seems that we could have a better connection with those programs and the education and benefits of becoming state certified. So we looked at the opportunities for increasing certification and developed about 15 recommendations, and I'm just going to highlight a couple of them for you. First of all, to follow up with businesses that do not complete their registration, encourage them to complete that registration process. As I said, about 25% of the firms that start the process for a variety of reasons do not finish it. The second recommendation was to create a direct referral system on the Secretary of State's Central Business Registry as part of the online business registration. In other words, we looked at maybe putting a checkbox or a line on the one-stop permitting forms that the Secretary of State has, saying, are you interested in state contracts? Check here for more information. And hopefully to attract more businesses in very early stages that might be interested in the kind of contracts we have available and the certification process. We recommended bundling smaller procurements and breaking down larger procurements so that potential contracts are more manageable by small firms. Again, making big contracts smaller and smaller contracts bigger so that they're either worth pursuing or able to be pursued by the small companies that we're targeting. We talked about updating agency vendor quote requirements to follow best practices. What does that mean? That means that we found some people that we thought were doing a really good job and that we could look at how we could take their experience and share it with other agencies so that everybody could be doing a better job. We also talked about creating a program to serve as a dedicated centralized resource to grow the number of Oregon certified businesses. That is to create one agency whose job it is to help people across the board rather than having a lot of different agencies in separate silos trying to deal with the same problem. We looked at research strategies. We looked at auditing and accounting systems to improve the timeline of getting paid. Because as I mentioned, getting paid and the issue of cash flow was a problem for a lot of these companies. So the full report that you've got on OLIS provides a lot of additional detail and documentation and statistics for you, as well as details on the recommendations that I outlined and the number that I did not. And it includes our thoughts and our recommendations about how to increase certification, support, and assistance to minority-owned, women-owned, and emerging small businesses in the state. One thing the report does not talk a lot about, but came up constantly during our discussions, was programs for disabled veteran enterprises. And we learned that there may be a lot of parallels in the subject area that our task force was asked to investigate and this other subject area that we were not asked to investigate. And so one of our recommendations is to take a look at that subject and whether we need a future task force to possibly look at veterans programs, or whether we just need to simply move toward consolidating all these programs into one consolidated approach, rather than having separate tracks for veterans versus women, minority, and emerging small businesses. Although we also learned, of course, that a lot of the disabled veteran enterprises also qualify as women-owned or minority-owned or emerging small businesses. So the task force feels that there's a need for increased focus and work to be done to nurture our relationship with the targeted firms. I'll just conclude by saying that it was a real pleasure to work with this group. We, as I said, spent 7 weeks meeting on a weekly basis, which was a fairly aggressive schedule. We put together a report that I think is very meaningful for you, and I really want to thank the legislators that participated in that process, the small businesses that joined us, the state agencies that were part of that, the individuals that came forward. And particularly, I wanted to thank Ms. Warner, who really did all the work while the rest of us just asked questions. And I'd invite any of you to ask us questions now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Would you like to say anything as well?
I have to say something.
Yeah.
Representative Kim Thatcher from District 25. It was a pleasure serving on the committee, but I just want to say that I'm here mostly just to not ask the questions this time, because I think it was pretty well covered. I don't believe there's any particular legislative move to make at this point. It's mostly administrative and bringing in cooperation from the agencies. And if that doesn't work, then we'll look at legislative fixes, but I think that's pretty much it.
Okay. Would you like to add anything, or are you just here to answer questions?
Good morning. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Summer Warner, and I will agree with Representative Thatcher, but we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions?
So maybe I just missed this in your reading the 43 pages, but I wasn't clear on what recommendations, if any, was addressed towards the issues of the complexity of the application process and or the information that's being requested, which does certainly have an impact on people's willingness to try to go through it. So was there a specific, did you mention that, or did I miss something?
Well, I'll just speak up a little bit. I don't think that there was it didn't call out a specific agency to deal with follow-up, but I imagine, just because the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Businesses, they deal with the application process, and so if there's somebody not completing an application, that they would be the ones to follow through and see why and see if there's any help that they need in completing it.
Thank you for that. I guess my question goes more to the changing that process. Again, I work with small business a lot of times, and so regardless, there's a reason for a lot of that information. I appreciate that, but in some cases, there's a reason for all of that, and especially the personal information that is all of that required necessary to put them through that in order for them to contract with the state.
Well, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Lively, the first thing we did is we identified the fact that people are finding the application process challenging. That's a first step. And then when you look at the application, of course, what you've got is a double-edged sword, because you want it to be as straightforward and simple and understandable as possible, but you also want it to be comprehensive enough to make sure that we're certifying companies that, in fact, should be certified and not letting some people slide through. Mm-hmm. You don't want a company that qualifies as women-owned when perhaps it's really not entirely women-owned. Did I say that?
Yeah, I think you handled it all right.
Discreetly enough. And so the recommendations that we really came to was not so much to remove questions from the application, but rather to counsel companies and assist companies that are going through the application process, so they understand the meaningfulness of the questions and are encouraged to complete them in order to complete the certification.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for your work on this. I had the opportunity to meet with the Small Business Administration, who was here in Portland. And one of the things that was talked about, it was a group of people who came together, was using some of the local resources that are already working with small business and women and minority-owned businesses in order to help get them access to these contracts. And did you talk about that at all in the task force?
Chair Kenny Guyer, Representative Vega Peterson. Short answer, absolutely. And one of the recommendations I did not detail for you here today had to do with the fact that the small business development centers used to have quarterly meetings to meet with these types of companies and with state agencies in looking at ways to streamline this process and to make it work more efficiently. And several years ago, I don't recall exactly when it was, that those quarterly meetings were discontinued. In the early years of the 2000s, they discontinued having those meetings. And we recommended that they start having those quarterly meetings again to do exactly what you're talking about, to strengthen the relationship between small business development centers, the businesses that we're targeting, and the state agencies that they're trying to work with.
And the associations, such as OAME, I can't remember what it stands for. OAME.
Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs.
Yes, thank you. That is one of the bigger organizations that comes to mind that would work with these SDCs.
Representative Holley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, since DAS was involved in this process on this task force, are there any indications that DAS is going to look to focus some more efforts in as a result of this report and try to focus on trying to address some of the recommendations and, you know, address some of the issues that come out? Some of the minority groups are very, very low, and maybe there's outreach. I don't know. Do they have already FTE assigned to do that kind of work?
Chair Kenny Guyer, Representative Holby, DAS was very involved with us in the entire process that we went through here. And as Representative Thatcher suggested, we're not looking for legislative solutions. We're looking at increased efficiencies and addressment of these problems administratively. And so I can say to you with some confidence that they're very well aware of the topics here. And I am very optimistic that they're going to begin to address the recommendations that we put forward. Did Representative Thatcher, you get that impression as well?
I do get that impression, but I do think it is also worthwhile to follow through with them and check. And I think what you're saying is we do need to have some commitment from these agencies that need to maybe adjust how they do things and how they reach out to folks.
Thank you. I think it would be wise to get a report back from them in the future and looking at this issue again.
Thank you, Representative Holvey. We'll make sure to put that on our agenda. I had a quick question also. Can you explain the nature of why non-certified companies go ahead and get contracts anyway?
Yes, Chair Kenny Guyer, the main thing is that there was lack of competition. Uh-huh. There's not that many people applying for a specific contract, particularly in some areas outside the geographic center of the state. And they're saying, I don't need to go through this application process. I'm the only one applying. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the end result of that is that we have targeted companies that are getting the work that we want them to get, but we're not not noting that,
right,
and applying it to our recording of our accomplishment of goals.
So they can still get it, but they tend to not be preferred if certified companies are competing, if it's not a requirement that they be certified to get these contracts.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, not necessarily.
Great. Well, did you want to say anything about the other members on the committee? I know it's in the report in OLIS, Senator Chip Shields, Senator Herman Bertschiger, Dana Young, is that how you pronounce the name? Owner of Project Design Group, Gail Castillo, president of the Hispanic Metropolitan Chamber, Sam Brooks from OAMI, the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, Diane Lancaster from DAS, and John Downing from Oregon Department of Transportation. So we want to recognize the great work that all of you did, and we will follow up and find out how it's being implemented. So thank you very much.
Thank you all.
All right. So Next, we have Representative Nancy Nathanson, accompanied by Twyla Lawson, on the implementation of legislation related to criminal records checks for licensure and employment purposes. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. A couple of years ago, an overwhelming majority of the House and the Senate voted on a few bills related to criminal records checks. Through that vote, I think it's clear that the House and the Senate, the legislature was saying the status quo is not acceptable. We had not a system of criminal records checks, but various disconnected processes and procedures for records checks being managed by over 50 agencies and independent boards, and they cover over 100, well over 100 different occupations. Through those bills, wheels were put in motion that you're going to hear the report. I'm very pleased that there is a lot of progress that has been made on some of the easier stuff. One of the harder parts, though, is getting the different agencies and boards and even individual school districts to agree on how to start changing. Each one of them has independent, unilaterally determined processes and criteria for determining ability or suitability for professions, even through these background checks, what makes it okay and what makes it not okay for you to be certified for this kind of a job. That discussion has started. It's not that there's a delay and it's not going to happen. That discussion has started and the work is underway. It's just that it will take a longer period of time to start aligning all of these different practices. But still, there's a lot of progress that's been made on three specific bills, and I'm just so pleased to have had updates over the past year or so on what's been implemented at each stage of the game. And I hope that the efforts, there's been a tremendous amount of energy, positive energy, put into this, and I hope that a half a year from now, we'll have another report on how much farther we've gone in the succeeding months.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Twyla Lawson, and I am a senior human resources consultant with the Chief Human Resources Office at the Department of Administrative Services. I have been assigned to facilitate the implementation of the requirements for these three bills that passed in the 2013 session, House Bill 3330, House Bill 3331, and House Bill 3168. I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide you this update, and of course, I'm happy to answer any of your questions that you may have. I won't read the full 25-page report. However, I will focus on the highlights. There is a lot to this, and so it will be a bit of detail, but I will try and cover it at the highest level I can. This report is based upon information available primarily to DAS and Oregon State Police, and information collected from over 50 public agencies and nonprofits impacted by this legislation. Many stakeholders have assisted at varying levels in all of the efforts that have occurred today. I believe it's valuable to note that as a result of the full implementation of these three bills, it is expected that impacted agencies and their applicants for licensure and employment will experience either both reduced cost or improved timeliness, one or both. So for the section one of the report is titled Status on Implementation of the Three Bills. So I want to explain that soon after the legislation passed, Oregon State Police and the Department of Administrative Services worked closely to determine where to start. There's a lot involved in these three bills. And it was determined that the best place to start and where the agencies impacted and the applicants impacted by these bills could see the quickest benefit was to begin the procurement process required in House Bill 3330. And that's related to the electronic capture and submission of fingerprints. To accomplish this, DAS procurement led the creation of a statewide contract. I'm happy to share with you that the statewide contract opened for contractors to apply in February of 2014, and it took a great deal of effort to get to that point. And then it was awarded in April and was finalized in July. So just this July. And the selected contractor was Field Print Incorporated, who has been providing this service for foster care providers through the Department of Human Services for several years. Field Print currently has agreements with over 30 small entities across the state in rural, metro, but covering the entire state. And they are working with additional entities to add to that number. Then they essentially would provide storefronts that people could go in and get their fingerprints taken. And some will also provide mobile service that someone could go to, say, a college or a university location and take fingerprints if there was a mass group of people who needed prints. The cost for capture of manual fingerprints really depends on the entity today that you go to, if it's a private or public individual that captures those hard card prints. The price that in our research ranged from, at some public entities free, all the way up to $30. So it was quite a range. And looking at the average looked like approximately $20, but you don't really know because you don't know who's going where. The negotiated rate for capturing the prints is $12.50. So we are very pleased with the rate that was received in the contract process. And we see in many cases that price difference will be realized by the applicant for a license. And in other cases, it would be realized by the entity that is requesting the fingerprints. The negotiated rates are expected to result in an overall reduction, I want to give an example that I received. So the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists began with Field Print in just the last month. And they have already experienced a very quick turnaround. Usually the next day the results are available in what's called the LEDS terminal, where they see the results of the applicant. And in many cases, this allows a person to receive a license, which allows them to begin working almost 2 weeks earlier. In addition, this saves money for the board as they don't have the time and expense of tracking fingerprints and sending the prints via service shuttle and money to the applicant. We have also not experienced any of the fingerprints being rejected by either Oregon State Police or FBI for poor quality. So that also is a huge service to the applicant and to the entity. I also want to share with you what this looks like in a data statewide level. So I can tell you in 6 months, there were 42,000 prints taken for this purpose. And that averages to about 80,000 a year. And currently, 83% are processed through hard card prints, where someone had to do an ink on a card and that card had to be mailed. And we expect through the implementation of this contract that 80,000 will go from 83% hard card captured to at least 95% electronically captured. So that's, I believe, a huge improvement in the process. So then the next bill that I want to speak about is House Bill 3331, and it's the Criminal Records Check Registry, where an individual, when their fingerprints are ran, has no history, and then they could opt to be part of this registry, that agencies could go to the registry and see if they are a member with clear history. So that registry has been created. The rules that need to be developed or in process, the Oregon State Police will be developing rules for appeals if someone is not put in the registry. And once that's done, we'll be communicating more on getting people into that, but we want to get the rules finished first. So then the next one, the third one, and the one that Representative Nathanson spoke about that's the biggest lift, is House Bill 3168. This bill requires DAS, in consultation with Oregon State Police, to adopt rules specifying categories of individuals for fitness determinations and for licensing and employment purposes. This bill also allows for the sharing of previously made fitness determinations to be used in the evaluation of subsequent criminal background checks. I did put some bullets in the report that I think are significant, but I won't read them because they're rather long, that illustrate what work is required by this bill. But I can tell you that to accomplish this task, it will require a significant amount of time and stakeholder involvement to establish uniform statewide rules. As an initial step, we are currently reviewing all of the related statutes and rule language related to this bill, and I can tell you the rule language especially is over 100 pages, several hundred, I believe. And our plan is to convene the work group next month to begin the work and develop a strategy for moving forward. I have also developed a website that will go live, hopefully by the end of this month, to use as communication. The most difficult piece of this project will be the consensus building among large and diverse stakeholder groups with differing opinions, interests, existing rules, practices, and philosophies. That, coupled with some of the other challenges, include limited staffing and no dedicated budget resources, will make completion of this challenging. So that's the kind of sum of 3168. Then I also included the study results that were required in House Bill 3330. But I do want to put the caveat on this, that this study was required so that they would review their processes and show that they had made improvements. But unfortunately, because the fingerprint contract is being implemented right now, a lot of agencies have not had the opportunity to fully realize those improvements. So you'll note when you read the study results that the agencies submitted, many of them have not realized yet process improvements because of the contract not being implemented for their agency yet. But I can tell you that that is in process, and I do not think it will take very long, probably a few months. So Section 3 of the report I included for historical purposes, legislation and reports such as House Bill 4091 report that was done in the 2012 session, and some additional links so that they were available to you. So that concludes my report, and I am happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Holby, he's getting back at me.
The Central Criminal Records Registry, I would assume that the people that voluntarily go into that registry, is there a periodic update to those records then once they're in that registry? And how often would that be?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Holby, and members of the committee, it requires an annual. So that they, once they are in the registry, they're in there for 2 years, and at 1 year, there's a state-only recheck.
And so that would follow up?
Follow up.
Thank you.
I'm getting back at you.
So who has access to that registry? I guess that's a question. Is it envisioned that at some point this registry might be available for private sector people who have potential employees in this registry?
Madam Chair, and Representative Holby, and members of the committee, OSP, Oregon State Police, is in the room, so you may want to. They may want to elaborate on this response, but I would tell you that the current legislation that put the registry in place specifies that it's those entities that have their authority through these statutes. Okay. So I would say at this point, it's limited to those.
Okay.
Yes, I'm getting a head nod.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a question about potential fiscal impact, because you talked about the last one requiring a lot of money that wasn't designated for this. Do you have any sense of how much that would be?
Chair Kangeyer, I at this point, and members of the committee, I don't really know. I think it depends on when we start the work group and look at what all the work is that it's going to entail. I know that there will be DOJ costs for sure. We know that there are statutes in place right now that will conflict with statewide rules. So there's going to be a lot of work there that needs to be done to figure out how to fix those. You know, we have entities that serve the same populations and have statutes that will block that. So I don't have, I think when we looked at it, we thought that there would be some position funding, but I can get back to you. I'd be happy to.
Okay.
Great. Oh, one more?
Yes.
Getting back.
Yes, I see that.
Thanks. So on this registry, then, I mean, one of the purposes of some of these concepts was to reduce the redundancy of having to do full background checks. So I assume that the rules that are in place from many agencies perhaps that require, a background check. The same individual has to go back and get another background check because they're working for a new client in the DHS arena, but still with DHS. Are those redundancies dealt with by rule and be able to access the registry to fulfill the obligation of a new background check?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, and members of the committee, I would say that right now the possibility is there, but with those rules still in place, once we implement House Bill 3168 and have the statewide rules, then I think that will reduce. But now that entity could look at opening up their rules and changing them to allow the use of the registry. But right now, I think those rules, I would actually want to look to DOJ and say if there's an opportunity there, but
okay.
I think that's, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to hearing the follow-up. Next, we have state regulation, and I want to make sure that the Gary Blackmore and Barry, who are coming in at the end, you can still stay to the end, and we'll stay in the order that we have here. Is that all right? So we're going to move on to state regulation of telecommunications industry and consumer complaints regarding telecommunications services and products. Quite a few people come on up, and this is partly in response to following up with the Attorney General's report to us on the 10 top complaints. And number two is telecommunications, and it's partly a complicated field. It's because it's regulated by so many different entities, so we just thought we would follow up on that area and get some clarity on that.
Thanks.
Who would like to start?
Okay. Well, good afternoon. Chair Geyer, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Brian Conway. I'm the Administrator of the Telecommunications and Water Division at the PUC. With me on my left is Stephanie Andrus, who is an attorney with the Department of Justice who represents staff. And I have her with me in case I get over my head on some of the questions about preemption and things along those lines. It's not always an easy, straightforward answer. And on my right is Mary Beth Henry, who I'm very happy she's here. You'll notice in my slide deck I do have some slides on cable regulation, but she's given me permission to defer to her. So she'll cover those. I'm going to leave them in here, obviously, for completeness, but I am going to touch mainly on what the PUC does with cable as opposed to overall the municipality regulation that she's more of an expert in. And that I remember to introduce myself, right?
There you do.
Okay. So, good. I thought I'd start by just asking you just to reflect for just a minute. I've got my iPhone here, which is now no longer the newest, greatest thing out there and quickly going to become obsolete, I suppose. And if you think back on what TV used to be like, but today you're watching things on demand, pausing movies, skipping commercials, doing all these types of things. The world's really changed quite a bit. And so when I was putting this together and wondering, you know, why is it that it's really confusing who regulates whom and what's regulated, what really struck me was is that the Telecommunications Act is 80 years old. And so it had a major overhaul 18 years ago, but also it was 30 years ago they added cable. And so when I look at this, we have an act that's very, very old that keeps getting kind of bandaged and overhauled as we go forward and clarified through different orders and things put out by the FCC. So I think that's the biggest reason why some of this becomes confusing. And we'll go with that. So the topics I was asked to address are state regulation of cable, wireless, internet access, satellite, landline. I can tell you the easiest ones are going to be satellite. There is no regulation of satellite for the state. And then services and products under the regulatory control of the FCC. I'm focusing mainly on the cable, satellite, and that. I'm not really going to get into how the FCC regulates profanity on TV and things. I don't think that's your interest. And then areas in which the state is preempted from regulating the telecommunications industry, I'm probably going to focus primarily on the information services versus telecommunication services. And hopefully I will keep things, the acronyms, to a complete minimum. FCC is Federal Communications Commission. I already dropped the ball on that one. So state regulation, this is a real easy slide, but I thought for completeness, all of these providers have to register with the Secretary of State. And so that's the only thing I have for this one. And these are the different services they offer. This is the cable municipality thing. It's a federal municipal partnership. So again, I'm going to defer to Mary Beth and move past this slide and get to the cable regulation that the PUC has. And for this, the cable industry has telephone service that they provide. It's essentially, it's a VoIP or voice over internet protocol enabled service. And what we do at the commission is, A, there is an access tariff. And what an access tariff is that for a phone to have any real value, you have to be able to contact everybody, not just people served by that phone or served by a different company. And so the companies, therefore, are forced or need to exchange traffic back and forth. And so when I hand a call off to somebody else and then they make sure it completes to their end user, I have to pay a fee for that. That's what access tariffs are. And so we have those in place. We have not had any disputes on the VoIP ones, but they are relatively new. The second piece is interconnection agreements, which is exactly what I was talking about. These are contracts where companies write down all the terms and conditions under which they will exchange traffic. That gets reviewed by the PUC staff, and then ultimately we generally work with them to get it right if it isn't right in the first place and recommend approval to the commission. And that allows them to exchange traffic, but should there be a dispute, then that's where they come back and our administrative hearings division hears that dispute as well as the commissioners if necessary. Then the last part is the VoIP end users pay the RSPF surcharge, which is the Residential Service Protection Fund. This has a few parts to it. It provides relay service helps provide relay service in Oregon for those who are hard of hearing. It provides specialized phones with people with disabilities, whether it be the video phones or big buttons so they're easier to work with. And then finally, it has a low income portion to it, which is a federal and a state. There's the Oregon Telecommunications Assistance Program and the Federal Lifeline Program that you may have heard about. And so all of these, the RSPF is a surcharge that they apply to their end users. What we do not have oversight over is VoIP market entry rates or any conditions on abandonment if they were to choose to abandon their service, TV and internet access. I will say that one thing that I'm going to be addressing on through these is some of the fees that people pay. And so for VoIP providers, the cable VoIP providers particularly, many of them do pay PUC fees. And the reason they pay PUC fees is, well, I believe they think it's the right thing to do. And we do provide the services up above between the with the interconnection agreements and the arbitration and disputes. And then some also pay into what's referred to as the Oregon Universal Service Fund. That's what is a subsidy that makes explicit a subsidy from urban areas to rural areas. It's more expensive to serve rural customers than it is to serve urban customers. So this is a fund that transfers money from all customers, but it spends it in the high-cost areas and the rural areas. And so some VoIP providers pay into that as well. And I think that's a good thing. It's a network that they all need to use, again, because phones are only valuable if you can reach everybody. All right. Wireless. The short version of this, lots of bullets on there, but the short version is it's pretty much identical to what I just explained for the VoIP providers. We have the same oversight with them. We have the access charges, the interconnection agreements. The big difference is that wireless does not pay PUC fees, and wireless isn't precluded, but they don't pay OUSF. They would be allowed to if they wanted, and actually we had a couple send us some money once, but they didn't have certificates with us, so we had to give the money back. And so, you know, that's the big difference between wireless and VoIP. They're both, I view as pretty light regulation. Satellite, this one I tipped off earlier, just the state is preempted in all levels of satellite, is from what I can tell. Let me go to the landline phone. This is the phone I remember having in high school and so forth, and still have today, actually. But the regulation varies between whether you're a competitive provider or an incumbent provider. So incumbent providers are like the CenturyLinks and the Frontiers, where the most important distinction, I think, is that first line. They have a dedicated service territory. That's their territory. And competitors don't. Competitors can serve in those areas and things like that, but they don't have a guaranteed franchise area. Both of them require a certificate, so we know who they are. They can pay us fees. We know information about them. Carrier of last resort, you likely have heard of that. If not, you probably will in the next few years. This is what's saying the incumbents. If we give you an area and say this is your area, you have to agree to serve everybody in that area. I don't remember the name of the bill, but there was a bill, I believe, in the last session that allowed for some carve-outs for gated communities. But other than that, they have to provide service to everybody. Service quality is we actually can go out, do tests. They report to us how they're doing, how quickly do they answer the phones, is there noise on the line, things along those lines. We do that for all of the incumbents, and the competitors we do essentially if they're big. They have to have over 1,000 lines before we're going to make them provide that kind of information to us. Service abandonment, in both cases, we do get involved in that. We're not here to stop them from abandoning service. Companies go out of business and all that, but we're here to make sure that they provide adequate notice to their customers so the customers know where they can go and have choices up front instead of just finding out their phone doesn't work. And then services and rates. We do not regulate for the competitors, so that would be, again, the VoIPs and the other ones. We don't regulate their rates and services. We do for the incumbents, and a couple orders are still waiting to come out, but I believe that soon all of them will be under either a price plan or a small company regulation, which allows them to essentially change rates without having to come to us and go through a full-blown rate case, which can be expensive. Let's see. All right. So then what landline phones companies pay into, they do pay into that Residential Service Protection Fund, again, for the reasons before. They do pay into the Oregon Universal Service Fund, but we do not have access or oversight over their Internet access or their IPTVs. And not all of them have them, but to the extent they do, we are preempted from that. All right. Cable. I'm going to go ahead and address some of this, even though it's probably a Mary Beth issue as well. The TV is Title VI, and she'll get into that. Internet access is Title I, meaning it's more of an information service. That's where a lot of times the FCC is regulating it. We're preempted. VoIP, when I write Title I, I don't believe the FCC has come out and said it is an information service subject to Title I. They did for one flavor of VoIP. But instead, they've said, we haven't yet chosen. We haven't decided. Is it Title I or is it Title II? Title II is more of the regular phone company type things. And so the distinction is it information service or is it telecommunications service? And the reason I think it's difficult for them to figure out is it acts like a phone, it works like a phone, everything's a phone, but it rides over the internet. So is it a phone or is it the internet? And in any event, if the FCC came out and said, we think this is Title II, they could also at that point say it's Title II, but we're not going to allow states to regulate the following things, or they could just say it's Title II and see what happens. I would suspect that they would be more limited in what they would say would be available to the states. And what we would not be regulating would be market entry rates and services. They'd still be a competitive provider, so it's similar to that. There we go. With cable VoIP. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me just make sure here. Oh, okay. I just switched over to the FCC regulation. I missed that. I apologize. So that's where I was going through. They have not decided whether it's information or telecommunications, but they're the ones regulating it right now. The FCC regulation over cable VoIP, they have them contribute to the Federal Universal Service Fund, which is had been, up until recently, quite similar to the Oregon Universal Service Fund, but due to a recent transformation order, is changing more into a broadband fund. The telecommunications relay service, very similar to our RRSPF-type program, and they do pay into 911. The obligations, I'll go through these once because these obligations show up for all the other providers as well. The first one, communications assistance for law enforcement, that's wiretap type things. They need to be able to work with them on that. The customer provider network information, they need to keep that stuff confidential. They can't be selling it off without permission from their customers. Disability access and equipment, those are kind of the specialized phones and things along those lines. Service discontinuance for non-dominant carriers. It is actually for dominant and non-dominant. Non-dominant have a shorter time frame that they have to tell people before they go. And I am not certain how the FCC determines who's dominant and who's not. They have to provide 911. They have to provide the relay service. They have to report outages to the FCC. And then finally, and this is one that seems new to me, but I know it's rather old, the number portability and number administration type items. They have to allow people to port their numbers to other areas. So next one is wireless. So the FCC regulation of wireless. This is interesting. I think the best way to do this is do a compare and contrast to VoIP, because it looks amazingly similar with a couple of exceptions. First, you'll notice at the top, the voice and data is Title II common carrier. So the FCC came out and said cell phones are Title II, but then they put in exceptions and said, but the states can't regulate it. So that one, I believe, that expressly preempted. So we are preempted from that. The contributions are the same. The obligations are the same with a couple of exceptions. One, wireless providers aren't required to provide the disability access equipment, but wireless providers are required to provide roaming, and it makes sense. VoIP providers, you're in your home. That's not really roaming. So that's the way that one goes. Satellite is a fairly light regulation, I would say, kind of all the way around. TV, there's really no oversight on satellite TV. They do have obviously some concerns over the satellites in space and the ground equipment, but there's really not a lot that I can tell that they do with that. They have guidelines for consumer dish placement and size, but I interpret that more as that they put the guidelines together so that states wouldn't have a role in that. They just wanted it consistent across the state or the nation. There's no oversight over internet access and no oversight over voice on the satellite phones. And so now this is the FCC regulation of landline phones. And one distinction I should have made is the state is interested in intrastate telephone calls, not interstate. Interstate is what the FCC does and is one way to look at how they try to break things up. And so for the FCC, the IPTVs, again, these are the, like a CenturyLink, if they wanted to roll out IPTV, the FCC would not add oversight over that. Internet access, I refer to it as oversight conditional, but what I'm saying here is that this is akin to if you want our highway funds, you'll make the speed limit 55. That's what the FCC does with this, is if, hey, back I said we have a federal universal service fund, they're going to give people money to build out broadband. If you're going to build out broadband, then there's conditions on what prices and speeds and latency. The speed and latency is kind of quality, and the price is, well, just clearly price. But it isn't required. If you don't take their money, you don't have to abide by their rules in this area. And then voice, they contribute to the Federal Universal Service Fund, Telecommunications Relay Service, and 911 as well. And all right, landline phones for the FCC again. This one is, can be the shortcut for this, is it's the exact same obligations that they put on the cable VoIP provider, except for, in this case, these are explicitly categorized as Title II. So that's my short way of saying it's basically the same, except for on oversight, they do have oversight over interest rate, long distance, and discontinuation of service. So just a couple minor differences between how the FCC regulates the VoIP providers and how they regulate the landline telephone business. And with that, I have, that's the end of the slides I prepared. I know I went through those very quickly, and but I'd leave it up to you if you want to ask questions of the entire group or if you have questions individually for me.
So I have a, before we get into the other part of the presentation, which I think goes into a different subject, I just wanted to ask, so when I, in the mid-90s, I worked for Teleport Internet Services, which is an ISP, and so a lot of the interaction that we had with the PUC was around kind of new regulations around the new technologies that were emerging. And so I'm just curious of how you feel your role and the organization is built to deal with the new technologies that come out, and how the regulations keep up with that, and the role of the FCC in dealing with the new technologies. I know that's a broad question, but I'm just mean like the, your agility to be able to keep up regulation-wise with new technologies as they emerge.
Sure, Chair Genny Geyer and Representative Vega Pedersen. Changing technology is, well, I guess I shouldn't say it's troublesome. It's very good. It's good for society and all that. The trouble goes back, I believe, to the patchwork trying to implement and update a very old law and bring it forward. I don't know that they're going to do it, but I've heard that there's some folks interested in trying to rewrite the Communications Act. So it would be the Telecom Act of maybe 2015, 16, something like that. And a former Oregon legislator is perhaps working on that, Ray Baum. But I don't know if they're going to get that done. As far as the probably with the technology changes, the biggest one we've noticed is people moving over to cell phones, you know, cutting the cord, so to speak. And as I went back to, you know, who pays the PUC fees and supports things like interconnection agreements and that, I think that's where we're seeing, you know, more of the difficulties. But it's but again, it's what consumers want. Right, they don't want the landline phones as much anymore, especially some of the younger generations and that. The second piece is the Oregon Universal Service Fund, which again is supposed to be helping ensure that rates stay low in the high-cost rural areas. It also is, you know, the reduced line counts as people move off to alternative things and aren't telecommunications, but they act like it, is causing some constriction on that fund as well. I believe that, you know, we'll be able to get through all that and come up with something good that still works, but we just have to, I think the problem is we kind of constantly revisit same problems over and over again. I hope that helps answer your question.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Hulley.
Thank you. Brian, I was trying to figure out, I noticed that the PUC has oversight over the landlines as far as service quality, service and rates, but I didn't see any regulation over any of the others in that same arena for the PUC. Are we preempted from regulating service and rates on those other, on wireless, for example, or is that covered by the FCC?
Okay, Chair Genny Geyer and Representative Holvey, A very good question, a very difficult one to answer. I think it somewhat depends. There's, as I was referring to, there's various types of exemption or preemption. So in some cases, it is not the case that the FCC has come out and said you are explicitly preempted from doing that. But as we look at it, and this is where all of these patching of laws and stuff is great for attorneys, full employment for them, because they get to go back and figure out, well, does it conflict with something, with another policy or a direction of the FCC, or is it, there's just not enough room for it. There's different flavors of preemption. Things that I think the state would have authority to do would be to perhaps, I don't believe we would have authority over rates so much. We perhaps could on service quality, but it's a different, we're set up service quality for an analog signal, not the digital voice over internet. So I'm not certain. That one would be kind of a gray area. I'd say it's probably likely we'd be preempted from that, but I'm not positive on that one. But areas that are consistent would be, I believe we would not be preempted from having them pay into the Oregon Universal Service Fund. Again, many of them are already. And I don't believe we would be, may not be preempted from abandonment of service to let people know. But all of that really, I think, would end up being basically we'd have to work with DOJ, and it would turn into hundreds of pages of legal briefs, I believe, before we'd know the answer to that.
Yeah. So just out of curiosity, when a consumer has problems with service quality or the rates not being what they thought was part of the contract, where do they go if you don't have regulatory authority over that, and it doesn't seem to be something the PUC deals with either?
Well,
FCC, excuse me.
Chair Jenny Geyer and Representative Holvey. I'm not certain if that's a hint that you want to segue to the next sections of the presentations or not. That is what they will be dealing with, is, you know, who handles complaints. I can assure you the PUC, I think Senator Beyer, when he was our chairman, made it very clear that we will take all complaints and we will try to help. But where we don't have regulatory authority, we don't have any hammer. We only have the ability to plead with them. But I'd say, you know, many of the companies really do want to know if customers have a complaint and want to resolve it. So sometimes it works out well. You know, the customer calls in, we call over to the company, and the company's like, great, we'll get right on it. Sometimes it doesn't work that well. But we do work on those. There is a partnership with Department of Justice and the PUC, so they take care of slamming, cramming, and other issues like that. I think the answer on that for competitive providers, if you don't like the quality of service or they won't answer the phone when you call, your best bet is to move on to somebody else.
So I have a quick question, but we can move on quickly to others. But, you know, I think one of the things I'm looking at is, what are the areas that are not regulated at all? And I was trying to discern from this which areas are not regulated by either PUC or FCC. It seemed like the satellite TV was one of the areas that was not regulated by either of those two.
That's my understanding. Entities. And the caveat with that is, since I don't really work in the arena of satellite TV, I learned some of this stuff the other week. So I'm telling you, there is not oversight, but I possibly could be wrong.
And the video service providers, I didn't catch who oversees that.
FCC.
FCC regulates that, okay. So anywhere in your presentations about where you see gaps, there's no regulation, there's no place to turn to complain or to track the complaints, that, love to see that highlighted.
I'll take
it.
Yep. Sure. I think she will. So, any more questions for me? I'm sorry.
Nope. Oh, yes. Oh.
Actually, I just have a clarification on page 19 and, well, 18 and 19 of your presentation. Looking at the keys, they kind of indicate the volume of PUC complaint, consumer complaint investigations, and it's broken out by category. There's other, water, cellular, and telecom are split apart, but then on the next slide, it talks about telecom in general, but does not, anyway, I was just a little confused as if cellular is lumped in with telecom here or not.
Chair Guinea-Geyer and Representative Thatcher, I think we changed the order up. Phil Boyle was going to immediately follow me, so actually that's the part of the presentation that Phil Boyle was going to provide.
So
we were substituting Mary Beth Henry Phil will come up.
So you'll be going
that.
Through those.
No, Phil Boyle from our office will be coming up and going through that right after Mary Beth Henry.
Okay.
And telling us whether telecom and cellular are lumped together on these complaints on page 19, or I was just trying to figure out where the cellular.
So he'll be going through those.
Okay.
He will be going through those
slides.
All
right. I'll defer
then. I believe he'll have the answer, but if he doesn't, I know he'll get it to you quickly.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Next.
Sure. Chair Guinea-Geyer, Vice Chairs and Representatives, I'm Mary Beth Henry, and I'm the Staff Director for the Mount Hood Cable Regulatory Commission and also serve as Manager for the Office for Community Technology at the City of Portland. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. Next slide. I think it's really important first that we all understand that cable TV was actually invented in Oregon. While others stake claim to that from Pennsylvania, I think it's important for this committee to know the truth. It was actually invented by Ed Parsons in 1948, and it's a really lovely Oregon history story. He and his wife went to a broadcasters convention in Chicago in 1948-47. She was really entranced with TV. I mean, it's not that long ago that TV was invented, 1947. And he wanted to do something nice for her, so he came back and he talked with the broadcast television station in Seattle and worked out a deal. He put an antenna on the Astoria Hotel and he ran a cable across to their apartment, thus giving his wife a fabulous Thanksgiving Day present in 1948. So now we can move on to the local regulatory, our local role in regulation and cable consumer or consumer protection. So as I mentioned, the Mount Hood Cable Regulatory Commission is an intergovernmental partnership among the cities of Fairview, Gresham, Portland, Troutdale, and Multnomah County. And as Brian mentioned, it's a kind of a unique federal-local partnership when it comes to cable. The 1984 was the Cable Act. Then there was an update in 92 and then 96. As Brian mentioned, I think in response to Representative Vega Peterson's question, I would say that we at the local level and at the PUC, we do the best job for consumers we can with the tools we are given. And the technology far exceeds and evolves more quickly than the regulatory framework, and it's an issue that we all face. So what do we do? Well, we protect the public interest in cable communications technology. The providers that we have are Comcast, Frontier, and Reliance Connects. Many of you experience this. The providers are bundling services. So while technically we at the local level have authority over the cable TV piece, when a consumer or subscriber calls me desperate for assistance, they are not interested that the internet is governed by Title I and is an information service, and that the phone is governed by Title II or a communication service, or cable TV is a Title VI service. They don't care and they don't want to know. They want to get their issue resolved. So, like the PUC, we take all of the complaints and help to the best of our ability to resolve the issues. And since we already have a contact at each of the companies to address the cable TV complaints, we also bring in these other issues that come up. Then in terms of complaint trends, No, that's correct. So this is just a screenshot of our website where we outline all the information, try to make it very user-friendly for consumers to understand how to make a complaint, what to do, the numbers of all the providers. And we also worked with Cub Connects. If you're not familiar with this, it's a fabulous tool that they have. You can put in your zip code and whether you want to find out the cellular services available, the landline services, or internet. Put in your zip code and up pops all the providers that serve your area so that you can do some comparison shopping. Mm-hmm. And if you're lucky, you will have some choice. There are parts of Oregon where there isn't consumer choice on those issues. So how do people find out about us? Our name, address, and phone number is on 160,000 cable TV bills that go out to consumers monthly in Multnomah County. And what we ask is for the subscriber to first try to resolve the issue with the company directly, and if they're not able to, then to call us. We have cable customer service standards that have been adopted by all of our local jurisdictions, call answering standards, installation, all the basic things that you would want in customer service standards. Okay, then let's go to trends. We usually see a spike in complaints the first quarter, and it's because a rate increase will have usually been announced just before that period, so that makes sense. In 2012 and 13, Comcast moved to a center of excellence model, and there were issues during those 2 years with meeting the customer service standards, but to Comcast's credit, they have addressed those issues, and all of the providers now in our area are compliant with our customer service standards. Next slide. In terms of the types and the percentages, the majority are billing rates, perceived hidden costs. That's when a subscriber will call and say, well, I thought I was getting this package and it was going to cost this much money, but I just got my bill and there are all these other charges and I don't understand what happened. Then there are the other kinds of complaints around equipment installation, picture quality outages. And you can see from the percentages, again, while technically we only have authority over TV, we do receive all the complaints because the subscribers, they don't distinguish what kind of service it is, so we need to help them. For any of you who have called, you've probably experienced an IVR. There's a lot of acronyms in this work. Interactive voice response, that's when you get a caller's menu. And so we have standards set for how the company meets the standards, and they report to us quarterly on meeting those standards. Regarding rates, we really have been preempted from regulating rates since 96. Most rates, the rates that the subscriber tiers that everybody subscribes to, the tier that's left is that very basic tier where you get the broadcast channels and the community media channels. We still have authority over that, but in many areas where there's what's called effective competition, they no longer even have that. But that is a very small number of subscribers, and it's an actual fairly low rate, somewhere around $13 or $14 a month. And I wanted to just touch on, because we manage the right-of-way on behalf of our community, we also play a role in wireline and wireless communications. So we do franchise agreements for use of that public property. We receive compensation, and then we have street use requirements, locates, you know, you need to get permits, and a lot of it has to do with public safety. We need to know who's in the street and when they might be working in the street. In the area of wireless, we have a program where we've partnered with the providers since 2002 in allowing wireless on utility poles in the right-of-way. And then wireless is also, of course, on private property. The private property is governed in each jurisdiction by the zoning code. In the right-of-way, that's a policy that my office established through our local council with the heavy involvement of both citizens and the industry. And because everybody's packing one of these days, there is an increasing need to site facilities. And in particular, as Brian alluded to, many people have dropped the landline service and they live in neighborhoods, but they need their phones to work. And so there's an increasing need to site facilities in neighborhoods, which I'm sure you can appreciate can be rather contentious. In those instances, I'd say the primary complaints from the citizenry have to do with RF emissions, which we and the state are preempted from considering when siting wireless. And they're also concerned about aesthetics and property values. We can move on. This just gives you an idea of what some of the facilities look like. I think a lot of times when we're talking about technology, we know what these look like, but I think it's really important for us to have a sense of what the facilities that make these work look like and where they might be located. Go on next. And that's a private property sites. One thing that's really helpful, I think, for everybody to understand is that the wireless facilities, all of the ones that you see here, they have fiber connecting to them. And so it's a myth to think that wireless is just wireless, because it isn't. Because of the demand, most wireless facilities that you see are going to have fiber, what's called fiber backhaul, going in order to be able to handle the capacity for it. So I think it's just good to understand that. I wanted to just touch real quickly on a broadband plan that we developed in Portland, and I know the Eugene area, and there were 8 other jurisdictions within Oregon who have developed these plans. Localities understand that both wireline and wireless service is really essential for our future, and we need to figure out a way to have it work for everybody. But again, wireless offers mobility, but you have to have fiber backhaul for it to work very well. And a final point is that everything is moving to internet protocol. So Brian mentioned the voice over IP. It's voice over internet protocol. When my sons watch TV, they're 18 and 25, their friends are all the same, they use their laptops or their iPads, and they're watching what's called over the top. They'll watch Netflix or whatever. So with everything moving towards internet protocol, and internet protocol right now is considered Title I, if you go back to what Brian talked about, from the local point of view, we look at Title I as not having any regulatory oversight. Maybe it's a light touch, you could look at it that way, but there really is almost no regulatory oversight over Title I. Everything, TV, phone, internet, is internet protocol. I think the writing's on the wall that something may need to happen because the technology has moved forward so quickly. And that just illustrates even the cell phone, 4G, is internet protocol. For the final slide, I just want to say that we'll continue to advocate for consumers. I take the calls periodically because I think it's really good for me as a regulator and a policy developer to talk with people who are experiencing the problem so I understand it firsthand. We'll continue to manage the right-of-way on behalf of our community, but the regulatory framework is subject to change. Right now, there are proceedings at the Federal Communications Commission, which could change the landscape. There are bills in Congress, which can change the landscape. There are cases in courts around the country that will change the landscape. And then, of course, the state legislature always has the opportunity within its purview to change laws. final point is that competition, which could provide consumer choice, would really help address some of the consumer protection issues. When you have a choice, you can move on to another provider. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
So if I understand, so when you talk about the regulatory framework subject to change, so it isn't necessarily it has to start at the FCC or Congress. It could start at any, since there is no, in theory, regulation now, it could start at any level and work its way back?
Well, technically it is Congress and the FCC with Title I, but sometimes a court case can put things in question.
And it depends whether it's preempted. Yeah. So that's the other question. It may not be regulated yet, but it may be preempted that states can't do it?
Yeah, Chair.
I'm thinking of the internet.
Well, yes,
satellite.
There could be preemption can happen where they're more explicit about what is allowed. But there are proceedings right now on net neutrality, on the merger of Comcast and Time Warner. There are different proceedings that are happening right now that could have ripple effects all the way down to the state and the local level.
Okay. Anyone else? Great. Thank you.
Andrew Scholl. Chair Kenny Geyer, representatives, Andrew Scholl from the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here, I wanted to get that on the record, I'm here in somewhat of a support role since we work closely with Phil and since we're talking regulatory infrastructure today. So I'll hand it over to Phil, but I'm here in case any questions come about regarding the interplay between our section and Phil and his great staff at the PUC. So, Phil.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. Chair Kenny Geyer, vice chairs and representatives. My name is, for the record, is Phil Boyle. I'm the manager of consumer services at the Public Utility Commission. And what consumer services does is we're the group that takes complaints from consumers about, you know, their interactions with their utility company. You all have these slides in front of you? Okay. All right. So what we do in brief, number one is we respond to questions from consumers about the utility industry, questions, complaints, you know, anything that's about the utility industry, and that's not just regulated utilities. That is also unregulated companies that consumers consider a utility. You know, most consumers, if you talk to them, would consider cellular a utility. Well, it's not, but consumers think it is. So we deal with regulated and a large number of unregulated. Large number of unregulated issues. Oops, I'm sorry. Some of the complaints we take, as I mentioned, we take complaints about regulated utility issues, so that's regulated telecoms, that's electric, gas, water, and then we can take complaints about cellular issues and some other unregulated things that some of the regulated utilities provide, like broadband and VoIP and some other things. So I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go. So this chart is just to kind of give you a snapshot of the kind of the numbers of complaints that we receive from the public, and this is just a set. I just picked the last 7 years for a snapshot for this, and you can see that pretty consistently over that time, the single largest area of complaints that we receive are telecom companies. Representative Thatcher noted earlier that how we're treating our cellular and telecom differently. The difference you know, in that, to answer your question, hopefully, is this slide that shows the telecom group indicates primarily regulated issues. Cellular, because it's not regulated by the state, we separated that out from the rest of the telecom numbers. So we don't really consider cellular telecom, like I said, even though the consumers do. So by far, between telecom and cellular, that's more than half of the number of complaints we receive each year. So to break that down a little bit, looking at the just regulated issues, the single largest issue that we deal with are billing issues. You know, I'm charged too much. You know, that's typically the largest complaint is, you know, I'm charged more than what was advertised to me. But there's a lot of different sorts of billing complaints. So that's number one. Service quality is surprisingly high. You know, scratchy phone line. You know, no service at all. It's, you know, you have a service outage. You know, poor service quality. So we still get a large number of complaints about that. Customer service is always a big number, and then disconnects. People can call us and complain my service was disconnected. You know, so we'll look into that for them. So the tall bar there, you know, really just adds up these first four columns, which are four big ones. And in comparison, the small bar to the right, the non-regulated, just shows, you know, the total regulated versus non-regulated complaints that we've taken over this period. So this chart then breaks down that non-regulated bar that was on the right of the last chart. And the single largest complaint source is cellular. And I'm going to talk a little bit about why we take these kind of complaints, even though we don't regulate these issues. So cellular is number one. The broadband, we take complaints about broadband. This is something that's fairly new. The bar is small at the 642. Those have basically all come in the last 2 years. So over time, broadband complaints, I expect, will increase pretty dramatically and be up more in the line of cellular. We also, again, same with VoIP. We've just started getting VoIP complaints recently, and we will try to handle those as well. And then the other is just a multitude of other things that we get complaints about, some of which we can try and help with, some of which we really can't. You know, and I've noted down at the bottom what some of those other categories are. And so the non-regulated work that we do is a fairly large piece of my staff's work. So, you know, one of the questions that we were asked to address was, how does the PUC and DOJ work together to resolve complaints and to not sort of duplicate efforts? So a couple things, and Andrew, feel free to jump in, you know, as we're going through this if you see something. So number one, with regard to cellular complaints, DOJ entered into an assurance of voluntary compliance some years ago with the major cellular providers, and you know, you can talk a little bit about that if you would like. But basically, the DOJ has entered into an agreement with the PUC for us to handle cellular complaints. So essentially, the PUC is enforcing the DOJ's assurance of voluntary compliance with the cellular providers. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. Chair Kenny Geyer, member of the committee, in what would be considered, I guess, the early days of wireless and consumer protection law enforcement, which was way, way back in 2003, we worked out several assurances of voluntary compliance with the major wireless carriers regarding early termination fees and contracts and some other comprehensive sort of starting your wireless service process, and entered into this agreement with the PUC so that the PUC could monitor compliance with those agreements. We've periodically added, I guess we've added one since then, to that one further assurance of voluntary compliance, which is a settlement agreement for folks that aren't familiar with that. And we'll probably add more in the future, since PUC staff is well equipped to sort of monitor compliance with those.
So the three companies that come under the AVC are Verizon, AT&T, and Sprint. And so my staff's experience in trying to resolve complaints with those companies is very good. Those companies are very responsive to us because of the AVC. The fourth large company that is not under an AVC, I don't believe they are anyway, is T-Mobile.
Correct.
And T-Mobile is a little more difficult for us to work with. We still try to work with them, you know, but they're not as forthcoming as the companies under the AVC. Point two, in working with DOJ, you know, because we don't want to duplicate what each other's doing, we come together and decide who's going to handle what kind of complaint, and so so we don't overlap. So point three is we actually meet annually with DOJ staff, with their consumer staff, and. Really just develop a list of, okay, you guys will take this kind of complaint, we'll take this kind of complaint. And that's actually the next slide forward. Some of the things that we don't do that we refer to DOJ, any complaints about false or misleading advertising, we send those over to DOJ. Things like elder abuse and scams, we send those over to DOJ. We don't handle TV complaints typically. We usually send those over to DOJ, but we will handle a TV complaint if it's part of a telephone company bundle. So if somebody has bundled satellite TV on their CenturyLink bill and they have some billing issue with that, we'll work with CenturyLink to try and resolve that. Sometimes we'll actually even go to the satellite provider like DirecTV or Dish, and sometimes they're responsive, sometimes they're not. So, we have some success there. And another issue that we handle, but this is a declining issue, is slamming and cramming. And again, this is something that we work with DOJ on. But the numbers of slamming and cramming complaints over the last couple of years has really dropped off. I mean, it used to be a big issue, and it is really declining. So,
ask what that is?
Apparently, I've never done it.
Yeah, well, I will explain. Chair Kenny Geyer, slamming is a practice where your telephone company was switched without your knowledge, either your long-distance provider, or it might even be your local exchange carrier. One day you get a bill, you get a bill from your phone company. All of a sudden your long-distance company is somebody you never heard of. It's like, I didn't do that. Where'd that come from? Uh-huh. That is slamming. That's illegal, of course. And actually, the PUC, we have opted into the FCC slamming rules, so we are able to actually enforce the FCC rules when it comes to slamming complaints. Now, the issue of cramming, that is when you're getting things put on your phone bill that you didn't order, like, your weekly horoscope or your weekly best friend, thing. There's zillions of these things out there, and those are put on the phone bills without people's permission. That's cramming, and that's been a big issue in the past with the landline phone companies, but it's certainly declining. But it's actually starting to be a growing issue with cellular companies, and that's in the cellular world. They call that premium text messaging, those are charges that typically are $9.99 a month, and these get slammed on or crammed onto people's bills. And of course, the intent by the crammer is that the people won't look at their bill, they don't notice this, and they just pay the bill. And there are a lot of people getting very rich doing that. So, but that's something that the FCC is taking seriously and trying to put an end to. So it definitely being successful in the wireline side of that. And then again, this is actually the referral guide that my staff uses on certain issues when we get a call about something, who's going to take this issue, us or DOJ. So again, the point is that we don't cross paths, or we don't duplicate effort. And my final slide, one of the questions that was asked was what kind of complaints are difficult for us to resolve because there's no regulatory structure. And so the four that kind of rose to the top here, number one is broadband and VoIP. Again, as you've heard all along, you know, VoIP and internet broadband is not regulated by the state, you know, particularly in the, you know, areas of, you know, pricing and, you know, billing and, you know, various things like that that we typically deal with. Even though we try to handle those issues, some companies, you know, are not very, let's say they're reluctant to give us information. Typically, your larger phone companies are, they don't really want the PUC involved in their broadband business, so they sometimes are reluctant to give us information, whereas Comcast, on the other hand, is very easy to work with. You know, they work with us very well at resolving customer issues and complaints. So, you know, that's an area where I wish we had a little bit more teeth that we could do something with those issues. Again, cellular, even though we get good response from the major three, you know, T-Mobile and some of the smaller cellular providers, difficult to get to get cooperation out of. So it would be nice for my staff if we had, again, some more teeth, at least in the area of consumer protection issues, you know. And then, again, TV as part of a bundle. So we don't take standalone TV complaints, but as part of a bundle, we do, and we work with those. But again, those are difficult because it's not regulated, and so we don't really have the teeth that we would like to have. And then finally, contracts, you know, particularly broadband and cellular contracts. You know, and it's just the same issue. It's the people that provide those services don't really, you know, want to help us help their customers, and, you know, they want to handle it themselves and just, you know, have the PC stay out of it. But, you know, the question comes to me from some of the industry is, why are you guys taking, you know, complaints about broadband and VoIP calls? And I say it's because your customer couldn't get satisfaction from you, so they have nowhere else to go. They come to us, so we're going to try and help them. And, you know, the response is, well, we would just like you to refer those back to us. And at some point, that may be all we can do. But it's like, well, I don't really want to do that because, you know, they didn't get the help they wanted when they went to you the first time. You know, so let us help you help. And sometimes we're successful, sometimes we're not. So that concludes my presentation. Any questions?
So I want to understand a little bit better this, the voluntary compliance. So I'm taken when we talk about these agreements with the providers, they're the whatever the agreements are that they're going to provide are based on complaints. And so since, you know, it's confusing about who has control or doesn't, or if they even do, so then you put in place some kind of agreement with the providers that they will do certain things if on these complaints, and then PUC follows up. But what's the if they don't? So you put in those quote voluntary agreements. If they don't, what's the options, or what do we do?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Lively. So to back up a little bit, the Assurance of Voluntary Compliance is a statutory settlement agreement under the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and it becomes the equivalent of a court order. And so to give you the whole full picture, Phil and his staff may be working complaints, resolving those complaints, getting individual refunds for consumers or whatnot, just like our office does on other complaints, but might see a trend, and so he may refer the information over to us. We'll then bring a law enforcement action or initiate that under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. If it settles with an assurance of voluntary compliance, that becomes an enforceable settlement agreement for us with the courts, and so Phil's staff monitors compliance with that and lets us know if we need to move on any enforcement action.
Perfect. Thank you.
I've tried to look at, you know, what are the areas that are not regulated or where we don't know where to go with complaints. It sounds like there are some areas that get referred to DOJ if they're not regulated by PUC or possibly FCC. So, again, I'm thinking about the reason I keep focusing on the satellite TV is because it came up as the second highest with 149 complaints in your top 10. Out of the telecommunications, cellular was 213, but you think about the number of people that have cellular, 213 for the number of people who have cellular, you take that into consideration. But satellite TV, 149, no regulatory body, but you handle then. So anything that in the chart there, DOJ handles those kind of complaints.
Correct, Chair Kenny Geyer, and I think that would be reflected in our enforcement history.
Right.
We have a lot of assurances of voluntary compliance and other stipulated judgments with various satellite providers.
Okay. Great. No more questions. So we did invite the following telecommunications industry partners to have a chance to say something if you'd like: Oregon Telecommunications Association, Comcast, CenturyLink, and the four big cellular providers. Are there any of you here that would like to comment on our regulatory system and our complaint system? Would you?
And thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much. It's a confusing area, but thank you for shedding the light on it.
Madam Chair, while they're coming up, I was just looking at Better Business Bureau and just kind of U.S. statistics, and it looked like the number one complaint was about cellular services and products, but it looked like all but 2% of those complaints to the BBB were resolved. I hadn't heard anything about Better Business Bureau. That is also an avenue for people. I just wondered if there might be a comment on that.
Thank you for that question, Representative Thatcher, and maybe you can weave that into your comments.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Doug Cooley with Comcast, and don't have any prepared remarks or response except to say just thank you for the opportunity to listen to industry and to kind of get our side of things. As you can tell, really, it was well covered. Technology does move quickly, and we, as an industry, try to respond to that as best we can, not only with products, good products that people want, but also with avenues that keep up with the times to resolve questions and complaints, resolving things. And I say questions because sometimes I think it's worth noting that some of those calls are actually just questions, and they're not actually complaints. They're more of clarifying and things like that that we find. We also try to do things to keep up with the generation that likes to do things online. You know, if it's frequently asked questions, they can resolve those online. There are apps for their phone and their iPad that can help reset their TV and you know, doing some of those things that are available online that are quicker and more interactive, and they're a techie generation, really. And so some of the adjustments that we make try to keep up with that reality, too. And then just to say that, you know, some of the issues that you may hear from time to time is us trying to, as an industry, I guess, seek uniformity. You know, you're kind of seeking if there's any gaps or any holes. You know, we, with a not perfectly up-to-date framework or, you know, telecom world, with the quick-moving technology, sometimes some of the issues that you'll see are rooted in uniform treatment of these different technologies. You know, if this is regulated, then so should you, and these kind of things. So comparison and uniformity is something that you'll probably hear from us from time to time. But you'll have to forgive me. I did not hear Representative Thatcher's question exactly, but be happy to answer any questions.
Well, it was just I just wondered if you get more interaction, perhaps it would be applicable to you to ask if you get more interaction, consumer complaint driven wise, from PUCs like utility commissions or from entities like the Better Business Bureau.
Madam Chair and Representative Thatcher, I don't have statistics, but I think it's a mixed bag. You're right. Customers sometimes are more familiar with a Better Business Bureau, or sometimes, as Ms. Henry mentioned, just see that number on their bill and call them first, or they're more familiar with, you know, the Public Utilities Commission because that number is on their gas or electric bill. Mm-hmm. So it truly is a mixed bag, and you know, it gives us, at the end of the day, it gives us an opportunity, as Mr. Boyle mentioned, an opportunity to resolve whether it's a complaint or just a question. But it really kind comes a little bit from a variety of directions. Yeah.
Any other questions? Mr. Cooley?
Okay. Hi, Barb Young with CenturyLink. And Chair Kenny Geyer, just a quick comment. I know we're getting short on time here. Just again, appreciate the opportunity to come up here and just kind of reiterate a couple of things Doug said. Brian Conway did a great job of kind of showing where the regulation is doesn't necessarily match the changes in technology that we're looking at. And Representative Vega Peterson, you brought up a really good point of, okay, what about Google, right? Google Voice. I mean, you think about that. But it really is a telecommunications product. What about Google Broadband? Google Broadband is no different than CenturyLink Broadband. Gigabit is gigabit, right? We may have a different way of delivering the applications, but it's essentially same technology. Everything we're moving to is that digital world. But yet we have regulations and statutes in place that were created when we were a monopoly. When that was the technology of the day. And so now it's a matter of how do we change those statutes, regulations to accommodate what we're seeing, which is a very large convergence of technologies moving to more just of a digital platform. And so it's a challenge. It's a challenge for me as a company. I'm sure it's a challenge for you as legislators to address really hard issues, for example, tax structures, which are outdated. How do we get that to where we need it to be? And it's a long, slow process. The commission has been great to work with on helping us get some regulatory changes in place that relieve us of some of our obligations and burdens, if you will, I guess, from a regulatory standpoint to get us more competitive that way. We still have some more progress to make. Carrier of last resort might be one thing that we need to take a look at. But again, it takes time, and we're happy to work with all of you to make that happen. So,
thank you. Great. Yep.
I'm curious before you get up as to, I think it was mentioned that the FCC is currently working on looking at telecommunications Act going forward. I would assume that you're involved in somehow in those discussions, maybe, or maybe it's premature, I don't know. And if in fact they're moving towards a kind of reform, I guess, to catch up with technology and all the different technologies that are providing communications as such, what do you think the state's role would be or should be in filling in, I guess, the gaps or putting in any kind of regulatory authority at the state level that would supplement where the FCC is at or going? Is that probably an impossible question, huh?
Yeah, we're all hungry. Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Holvey. I can speak to it from one aspect. I've not heard a lot about let's redo the Telecom Act, right? Although there's been discussions around it's outdated. Where do we go next? But there has been a lot of work at the FCC lately with regard to universal service. And the fact that the existing fund, which was a voice fund, is probably outdated. It accomplished the goals it was intended to, which is to get voice service out to 96%, 98%, somewhere around there. But now, is it just as important to have that broadband capability spread out to everyone also? Is that an objective? And the FCC has said, yes, we think that's an important objective. How are we going to get it done? So part of it is now looking at once that is completed, once the FCC, and it's called the Connect America Fund, once they've completed phase one, now we're going to be getting into phase two. Once that's done, is there still an opportunity then for the states to take a look at, okay, is broadband a priority for my state? Is broadband a priority for Oregon? And if the state determines that, yes, it is a priority. We think it's a priority for economic development. We think it's a priority for education. We think it's a priority for health care. Then there definitely is a straight role in trying to figure out how do we make it happen then? How do we make sure that our state has the capabilities it needs to both rural and urban to achieve those goals from a broadband perspective? So that's one piece that definitely I think the states will have a role in. What will the states be left with from a regulation standpoint when it's all said and done? I can't even begin to guess because I have no idea how those chips will fall, right? Mm. So
That's really helpful. Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, great. That was a great overview. A lot deeper dive into the number two telecommunications on the DOJ list. So our last panel now is the recommendations presented in the Secretary of State audit report, boards and commissions, common risks, needed oversight, and steps to manage them. And this is a little bit of a repeat of what you did 2 years ago, which really caught my attention. It was a very compelling case about the need to try to contain or manage this animal that we've created with over 250 boards. Please come on up. And I think what we're curious about now is what is the work that's been done, which will be your follow-up, and what still needs to be done. And I am really hoping that either individuals on this committee or the whole potential committee bill will take some piece of this on in 2015. So I hope you don't feel that you keep telling the same story. We want to get an update on that and then see how we might move forward at this point in time.
Chair Kenninger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the director of the Audits Division in the Secretary of State's office, and thank you for your continued interest in this issue. Sometimes audits take a while before the recommendations kind of take hold, and so this is one of those areas that we put a considerable amount of work in. We issued the report in June of 2012, and the objective of the audit was to provide an overview of state boards and identify ways to improve governance and operations of those boards and to promote accountability. We did a lot of research, and we found that many states utilize boards, commissions, and councils to allow subject matter experts, members of the public, stakeholders to take part in various state responsibilities. And Oregon actually has a very long history of boards. In fact, two boards predate the state itself. And we found that during that time, from two boards to 250, various governors and state leaders have attempted to limit, reduce, scale back the boards and commissions, but we haven't seen a drop in the numbers in the last 150 years or so, that they continue to proliferate. And when we looked at the boards, we found that they fell into five broad categories. Advisory boards, which essentially do what they say. They advise on policy matters, and there's about 125 of them. Governing boards, which direct a state agency or appoint an agency director. There's about 50 of them, and Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, for example, is one. Licensing boards, such as the Board of Nursing, there's about 40 of those. Policy boards have statutory power to make policy decisions and enforce regulations, such as the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. There's about 20 of those. And then judgment boards, which conduct hearings and rule on individual cases, such as the Workers' Compensation Board. There's about 10 of those. When we looked at these boards and looked at prior audits and audits from elsewhere and studies, we found that there is susceptible to certain kinds of problems, especially those that have small staffs, that because of their structure and size and responsibilities, they are susceptible to financial challenges like segregating duties, and that a lot of times they lack the technical expertise and skills to be able to manage their finances properly and run into difficulties that way, which is when we get called in. We also note that they, because of their small size and some of their difficult responsibilities, they really have a hard time assessing whether they're accomplishing their objectives or not. We intended in this audit to survey every board to get an understanding of what they did, and what we found was that it was very difficult to identify who the boards were and who their contact people were. So we ended up trying to at least compile a list instead of actually doing the survey. So we, in the appendix of our audit report, you'll see that we have each board that we found, its mission, number of board members, who appoints them, the year it was established, its enabling statute and website, if it has one. So We also looked at what other states were doing around boards in terms of accountability and governance. And what we found was that they had a variety of strategies to manage. They had things like sunrise and sunset requirements. Colorado, for example, really discourages boards that do not address public health, safety, or welfare issues. Maine requires certain information on over a dozen aspects of the proposed board that need to be considered by the legislature before it can be created. Sunset reviews are the other end of it, where there's periodic mechanisms to force consideration of each board. Texas requires each licensing board to undergo a sunset review every 12 years. The Washington Governor's Office underwent a sunset and eliminated or consolidated 143 boards, and it proposed the elimination of another 36 as our audit was being completed. I should note that Oregon had a sunset law that was enacted by the legislature in 1977, but then 16 years later, in 1993, it was discontinued because during those 16 years, it only eliminated four boards. So the sunset board was sunsetted. Other states have eliminated boards through consolidation, where they see boards with similar roles and responsibilities and put them together, or they create ad hoc committees, because there are cases where an issue comes up, it's dealt with, and they can dissolve the board and not have one that's active during interim periods. The 1999 legislature applied this method in creating the Health Licensing Agency, which provides uniform professional licensing in 9 health fields. So the recommendations that came out of this were that because this is really an issue between the governor's office and the legislature, we made recommendations for both to consider compiling and maintaining a list of boards and their members, that they consider the strategies of other states to manage boards, ensure all board members receive training on state rules, consider whether statutes of the board set clear expectations of the authority and responsibilities of board members, require periodic fiscal and operational reports from the boards, establish a mechanism for handling complaints regarding the board, its members, and activities, and periodically review the activities of the board to help identify boards that could be eliminated or consolidated with another. So that's essentially what we did in that audit, and I thank you for the opportunity to raise this again, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Thatcher.
Well, just if you, okay, I know the audit found like 250 boards and commissions, but if you add in all the, I don't know, task forces and other governing bodies, well, and agencies, there's this list. It's over 600, and I mean it's worse than even what you're stating in your audit report. Are we going to hear from the governor's office? I can't keep track of who's with who. Okay, so you're going to let us know. All right, thanks.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Barry Pack, Acting Deputy Chief Operating Officer in the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm here to represent the work that we've been partnering with the governor's office on. Unfortunately, Kendall Clausen, who handles most of these issues for the governor, was unable to be here today. I just want to start by thanking you, Madam Chair, for continuing Representative Holvey's tradition of having DAS present at the very last of the agenda on the last day of legislative day so that we can effectively clear the room and get the highways clearing for you as you go home.
Really, you could get moved up.
I'd like to just hit a couple of high points of work that we've been doing over the last year or so to try to begin addressing some of the recommendations that are more operational that comes out of the Secretary of State's audits within the resources that we have available to us. One of the principal things that we identified out of the audit was that training for board members was a big issue. Not only what was that creating a risk of liability to the state on personnel matters or financial matters. There was just lots of other opportunities for mistakes to be made in public meetings, laws, and public notice, and all those sorts of things. And so we've put together a very basic sort of chair an administrator 101 training curriculum for board executive directors or administrators and board chairs that we have begun providing just this year. We've done 5 trainings so far with a total of 50 board chairs and 59 board administrators going through it, setting out some of the things that the audit recommended in terms of expectations about resources that are available for them, about the laws that apply to board members as public officials, so both ethics rules and statutes and all those sorts of things that govern them, trying to make it clear about roles and responsibilities. So when the board has a policy issue, understanding that they have a policy advisor in the governor's office that they can go to look for guidance and direction. If they have an operational question around personnel matters or public meetings laws, they know that they get to call me at DAS for information on how to do that. And then if they have issues relating to the board itself, if an executive director is finding that the board is not functioning well or if there are issues there, to be able to go to Kendall and have some help addressing those. We're in discussions now about how to develop a curriculum that is broader, that dives deeper into some of the more operational issues that board members face. So, you know, working on a public meetings and public notice and public records training, working on personnel HR matters for those boards that supervise staff or an executive director, financial and accounting practices, those sorts of things. We at DAS have recently negotiated a contract with Chemeketa Community College to provide some training for state employees on these sorts of management issues. It's a really great contract at a really remarkable price, and the trainer is getting good reviews. And so we're looking at the opportunity to try and expand that contract with Chemeketa so that they could provide a more regular series of training so that we can get beyond just the sort of initial round we've done with board chairs and board administrators and broaden that out to more board members. We've also been working with boards and commissions on a quarterly report that we'll be sending out for the first one starting next month for the last quarter of the year. It's going to be an online form using SurveyMonkey, which the state already has a contract with, and it will go to every board and commission that we've identified that is a governor-appointed board or commission, and it's about 332 right now in the list that we're operating from. And it will be, again, it goes to both the executive director and the board chair, if there is an executive director of the board, and it asks them some basic information, what's a board management update, how are the meetings going, do you have any vacancies on the board, are there any issues or training needs or support that you need, an operational update in terms of the work that the board has been doing, how their budget is holding up, if they have other issues that are out there working with their stakeholders or constituents, a request for a policy update, what are the issues they're seeing if they're a regulatory board or an advisory board that needs to get communicated to the governor's office and then to the legislature as well in terms of public policy issues, and then just a generic request for assistance. So this will be going out each quarter. It'll come back. The SurveyMonkey dumps it all into a spreadsheet, and we'll be able to track progress over time. And that was it's not quite the level of financial reporting that I think the audit suggested, but it was something that we could implement relatively easily. And we've gotten feedback from a large number of boards and commissions, and they're all quite willing to provide this information. So we'll be able to start tracking back and reporting on that. The governor's office has done their best of their ability to compile that list that Gary's audit recommended. As I said, there's 332-ish. They change. Sometimes when you come into session, that list grows, and sometimes it hasn't really shrunk recently, but it has grown. And so we are sort of trying to figure out a ways to make sure that we can maintain that so that we're always tracking when new boards or commissions get created. But again, as Representative Thatcher said, that does not also include all of the task forces and work groups that either get established by the legislature or by an agency, and those are a whole nother realm. So those are the high points here at the end of the day, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, I have more of a comment. I think the one thing, we have lots of boards and commissions and task force, but if you look at the kind of the glass half full, there are also a lot of Oregonians that are not involved in state government, that are not, that are just community members that are involved and giving their input in a lot of programs that we have in the state, and I think that's one thing that's also important to look at. But I'm impressed with the idea of the reporting system, so at least you'll have a handle on what the 4,963 commissions and task forces are doing.
Mm-hmm. Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Doherty, thanks. And yeah, I think there is something like over 3,500 Oregonians who are currently serving on a board and commission, and they do provide a tremendous service to the state.
So I commend the efforts from the standpoint of training that, but the point I guess I want to go back, you're talking about 332-ish. So does that mean that when you talked about that number and the fact that we're trying to do training, that we've already made the determination that all of those are necessary, required, producing, you know,
Madam
when
Chair,
you're talking about training, that this is a big deal to get that many to train them and do those things. And so I'm trying to understand what's driving it from that standpoint.
So Madam Chair, Representative Lively, from the beginning of this sort of training exercise, we looked at the ones that had actually had staff associated with the board, because that's where more of the issues come in terms of personnel matters, in terms of they have a budget, generally speaking, and there are control issues that would need to be in place. So that's where we started. Okay. We haven't done the sort of broad discussion around are they producing. Okay. As we start getting some data in, we'll have something then to go off of rather than just sort of anecdotal assumptions.
Thank you.
I have a question about some of the ones that you couldn't even locate. Is that still the case as of 2 years later from this report? Are still commissions out there you can't locate?
We identified, I think, about 250, and the recommendation was to see if we could inventory them. And since they've hit 332, I think that's definitely, they probably searched in every corner. But many of these are in statute. Some of them are in administrative rules. So it took us a while to find those we could. And I think that's one of the issues where it really is a statutory for many of these, and even if the governor's office feels like there's some question about it, it still requires the legislature to step in and agree on that. And I think that's where the difficulty comes in, is that these are groups of people who are dedicated to a particular issue and committed to it and feel like they're adding value, and telling them that they're not needed can be a difficult conversation to have.
Thatcher?
Thank you. I did hear you speak of some follow-up with some of these boards to kind of see how it's going, but is there something that you guys have in mind? One of the recommendations, for instance, was implement a periodic and systematic monitoring and reporting structure to help identify underutilized boards and boards whose functions could be eliminated or transferred to another existing board or agency. Is there some sort of formal process you're anticipating putting in place?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I think the quarterly reports that I was talking about start to begin to give us some of that data. So in terms of how often they're meeting, what major issues they're working on, so that if we continue to see a board that over time, because board activities will cycle, right? They'll go through trends. But if we start seeing boards coming in where there's long cycles of little issues coming up or they're just not meeting, then that becomes a great place to start looking at whether or not they're meeting their statutory requirements, if that need is still there, if it can be absorbed into other work.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Holby.
Thanks. It's a daunting task, I'm sure, to think about trying to get a handle on all the boards and commissions and inventory them to start with. But is it contemplated that you'd also look at identifying what the particular board or commission's mission is? I mean, do they all have like a purpose and a mission statement, and you know, someplace down the road? I know LFO does some review of boards and commissions, but I don't think they're able to do much about some of them as well. So sort of a mixed bag of, you know, our ability to really review, you know, the purpose and whether they're accomplishing that purpose or not.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's also an important element. And so I'm wondering if that step is going to be included in your survey, initial survey, or something in the future.
Yeah, so Madam Chair, Representative Holby, a, c- a couple of points. I want to go back to how I started, which was that we were focusing on the audit recommendations we could implement with existing resources. And one thing that we have to keep in mind is the governor's office has two people who manage appointments to 30, you know, to the 330 some odd boards and some 3,500 people. So the ability to do lots of monitoring is limited by the resource that we have. They did put together the a master list of all of the boards and commissions, including some of those missions and things like that. They've also been converting all of the historical files to electronic so that we have greater ability to disseminate information and work with those boards directly. Kendall has also been going to a lot of the board meetings where she can to help and just sort of hear how things are going and take a look at what is happening. And so we are trying to get to some of those core issues. I think it's important to keep in mind, though, that it's not – this work is about trying to provide greater support and assistance to boards to be successful in the work they're doing. It's not a fishing expedition for boards that should go away. We might get some data in the course of the events that suggest to hear some things the legislature might want to look at, but it really is – our focus is really about how they do their jobs, whether they're paid or volunteer, better.
So follow-ups?
Yep.
So, Madam Chair, I if we were able to put you at the very front of future committee hearings, you'd have more time to get some of this done, probably, huh?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Just like to point out to the committee that there are 14 pages under state agencies that list all the boards, commissions, agencies, starting with the Access and Habitat Board and going to the Workers' Compensation Board. It's all listed here. Mm-hmm. And that the governor's office has multiple vacant positions that if they needed more help, he's got the capacity in his office to apply and get additional people to do this if this was a higher enough priority. I think, by the way, just a suggestion is the way you approach it is you look at each one and you say, if it didn't exist today, would we create it? If the answer is no, then you may have outlived its usefulness. But that's just a Peter Drucker kind of approach to things that's very common sense and it works really well.
Well, and it goes
it sounds
to the
like
Sunrise.
That's what they're doing.
The, some of the suggestions that looking at Sunrise, is there a legitimate need for this? And I just have a question also about mergers. Is your office looking at how some might consolidate? Is that part of – I recognize there are only two people. It's a huge task, and you're taking part of the recommendations.
Yes, Madam Chair, we are working on a couple of ideas. One is how you better support staff that are or support boards that are related, if not considering merging the boards themselves. So we've been running a pilot project this year with the trying to get all these names right. So it's the Board of Psychologist Examiners and the Board of Licensed Counselors and Therapists. Similar functions, they regulate professions. They're in the same building, and we've been working to actually merge the staff together through interagency agreements so that they have a single administrator and executive director. They have staff that supports both boards, both investigations and sort of administrative support. And so we're looking to see how that works through this biennium to see if that's a model that could be replicated in other areas. It's a little bit different from the Health Licensing Agency, which the legislature moved into the Oregon Health Authority last session, so it's not its own standard alone agency any longer. So there are a couple of different models that we're looking at in terms of the staff support to provide the greater ability to have some of those separations of duties and controls as well.
Chair Kenninger, I was just going to mention that has happened in the past, like the Agricultural Commodity Commissions. They all operate under more of a centralized and albacore commission, alfalfa seed commission, beef council, blueberry, clover seed, dairy products, Dungeness crab, fine fescue, hazelnut, hop, mint, potato, processed vegetable, raspberry and blackberry, ryegrass, salmon, sheep, strawberry, sweet cherry, tall fescue, trawl commission, wheat commission, and orchard grass seed producers. So, I mean, you start getting a sense of these are all very committed agricultural interests.
That could probably be consolidated.
Right.
Well, I also find it interesting that in your Appendix C, quite a few of those were listed as ones that didn't respond, which may say something about their capacity. So,
And real briefly, because last session we did, I think a bully brought up a commission that had not met in 15 years. Mm-hmm. And but it was set up statutorily. And so statutorily we got rid of it. And so I think some of the agencies are also looking at their commissions and boards and saying, do we really need this? So,
I'm delighted with the progress to date and eager to be a part of helping that go forward. So if anyone else is interested in that, please let me know.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? So the last thing on the – thank you so much. The last thing on the agenda is if anyone here on the committee would like to have an opportunity to say either personal bills related to consumer protection that may go through this committee or bill concepts that they would like the committee to entertain as a committee bill.
We will let you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's an invitation.
That's an invitation to say if you'd like to share with people some of the things that you're thinking about that you might be introducing on September 22nd or before or after that date.
Bills, but it won't be presented. So should we send you a list?
He's probably got a long list.
Yeah. No, everyone except for Representative Holdy
can send a list.
The limit's one, right?
Yeah. I just wanted to give you an opportunity if you'd like to say anything on the record about a bill concept. If not, that's fine. Hopefully we will put that back on the agenda in December and give you another opportunity to say what you might be presenting if at that point you're ready to share. So thank you, everyone. And I hereby adjourn the committee on interim committee on consumer protection government efficiency. The committee on interim committee on consumer protection government.